For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, it's time for a debate.
What's that?
That's a lost art is what it amounts to. If anybody happened to notice the Democratic presidential debates there a couple weeks ago, I don't know, I was in debate club in high school, and what I experienced in debate club and what I saw on the TV screen, no, that's not a debate. That's not what I remember debate being.
Yeah, there was lots of interrupting, and that was the big no-no in debate club.
I mean, you know, in debate club, it was always, remember, this needs to be civil discourse. Well, civil got thrown out the window.
Right.
Now it's a matter of who can shout louder over the other one. And it's not just the presidential debates. Anytime you turn on the news, if you have two opposing viewpoints, it's who can be louder, who can shout down the other one. And it seems like civil, quote, civil discourse is a dead art.
Yeah, and it's even spreading beyond just trying to shout down somebody or be the loudest. You know, there's this move in society to try to, I guess, get rid of opinions that you disagree with, completely shut down, you know, through coercion, the ability of anybody to counter your thought, counter, you know, what you say. So the idea of actually arguing a point, the idea of actually trying to change somebody's mind on a position has really gone out the window.
Well, it's become one-sided. Everybody wants to speak, but nobody wants to listen.
Yeah, I think that's you guys are both right. It also includes, I think, not only this unwillingness anymore to try to convince others or persuade them, but often we ourselves are not, to your point, Kent, docile enough, right? Teachable enough to want to pursue the truth as, say, one of our first principles or first commitments.
Oh, dare you use that dirty word, truth.
Right, right.
Well, and I think that's part of the problem. You know, these non-debates, these shouting contests come about usually on moral issues or political issues. Mm-hmm. You know, you never notice two scientists sitting in there that might disagree. You know, there's a lot of disagreement within science, but you never notice them turning into this giant shouting match of just like, well, be quiet. Don't bring that up. There's something about science called there's actual truth out there that the scientists are pursuing that doesn't lend itself to, I guess, quote unquote dialogue by trying to shut the other person down and just insisting on my opinion over your opinion. There's something that can be reconciled between two opposing positions, and there's some almost overarching referee in the room when you're dealing with scientific fact.
Yeah, it seems in that pursuit of scientific inquiry, there still remains predominantly the notion of objectivity, that there are objects outside of oneself that in reality that one can come in contact with and possess. And so if, as fellow scientists, we both have that as one of our first principles, that there is an objective reality, a set of facts or evidence that we can both independently verify, then that means that we would move from one position to the next and allow ourselves to what, because we want to what? Possess the truth of things. I think when it comes to the political sphere, the moral sphere, the ethical sphere, we've generally abandoned the notion that there are objective truths or objective facts that we can share and come in contact with, and therefore everything is just subjective. And if everything's subjective, then there really doesn't seem to be a good path forward for us to find common ground.
Yeah, and it's an abandonment not just of, I think, the idea of there being a moral truth, but I think there's an abandonment to a certain extent of the whole moral project. In other ways, you know, I think we've even lost sight of what the purpose of moral thinking and ethical thinking is to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea behind morality and ethical thinking is to figure out the best way to live.
Right.
What, you know, what
going
is
back the, to Aristotle.
Right. Exactly. What is the best way to be a human being? What is the best way to achieve what we're supposed to achieve within human life? And what's the best way to come together to form a community? And what's the best way to come together as a community to be stewards of our world? You know, all of these things fall under the lines of what is the best way to do something. And that went out the window a long time ago, thinking of morality in those terms. We now try to think of morality in terms of, I guess, a theoretical science. In other words, what is the morally right or morally wrong thing? And those terms get empty. Those terms get empty very quickly. Margaret Anscombe was one of the, most eloquent or ineloquent proponents of that, you know, of saying, you know, we the idea of moral doesn't add anything. It's linguistically empty. It's an empty term. When I say something's right or something's wrong, I don't add a single thing to that thought when I say something is morally right or morally wrong. Those terms are exactly the same thing. So the idea of morality, this is what Anscombe was pointing out, the idea of morality is empty.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a big part of the problem of our contemporary setting, Mark, is that because we've abandoned objective truth, that reality is actually outside of ourselves and things are not just simply merely subjective, then there are a lot of ramifications that flow from that sort of position. One of which, as you're pointing out, morality in and of itself is then relegated to the realm of mere subjectivity, meaning I get to determine what right and wrong is for me. You get to determine it for you. And if we disagree, then the next move tends to be towards maximizing autonomy and choice. And those are the two, I would say, predominant characteristics of the current setting. Is we have this strong preference for maximizing our own autonomy and choice such that we can pursue our own subjectively determined goods.
Yeah, and you know, those sound like great things. I mean, nobody wants to be against the idea of autonomy, of being my own person, of you know, really honestly living my own life without it being interfered with by other people. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to really argue with the idea of choice, to be perfectly honest. As much as a bad word as that's become because of the abortion debate, really when you get down to it, nobody wants to disagree with, well, I should be able to choose the way I live. I should be able to make choices. I should be able to have, you know, that ability to choose. But you're exactly right. At the root, I think, of our inability to discuss moral issues is that idea of radical autonomy, where what you choose to do and how you live your life doesn't impact me, and how I live my life doesn't impact you. And when it does, that's an imposition on my freedom. And one or the other of us has to do something about that. And it can't be argued. You know, there's no, Alistair McIntyre used the term commensurability. So, you know, anybody that goes back to seventh grade geometry remembers, you know, the commensurability or incommensurability of angles, right? So
that's also a great Scrabble word, by the way.
Right.
Or Boggle, if you like to play Boggle.
But it simply means that these things just don't compute. You know, not only do we disagree, but we're not even talking about the same things. You know, you're talking about football. I'm talking about oranges. And we can't, you know, we can't discuss them because we're talking about radically different things. And, you know, McIntyre did a great job of going back and I think cataloging how it is we got to this point. And for him, the basic problem is we have a fundamental misunderstanding of what ethics and what morality is. Unlike other sciences, you know,
chemistry,
biology, physics, et cetera, physics. Yeah. It is not a theoretical science. It's a practical science. Mm-hmm. It's not a what is this or why is this, but a how is this? How can I do this? How can I achieve that? How can I get it? It's goal-oriented. It's teleological is the big philosophical word.
Right.
And as we've lost that, we've lost the inability to discuss, because we've lost the inability to discuss what's best, what's better, what's worse, what's good.
Yeah, that's linguistically, you've really put your finger on it, Mark, because we no longer, I've brought this up in conversations, we've lost our ability to engage in shared conversation and dialogue around good, better, best. Instead, we've abandoned those terms generally in favor of different. It's just different. You know, that way we don't have to make any sort of assessment as to the quality of, say, the act that we're talking about, or the way someone's living. They're just different. Instead of going back to, as you mentioned, like McIntyre, who's retrieving a lot from Aristotle, talks about a way of being in the world to achieve something that we might translate as happiness or holiness or blessedness. And that's the one thing that all of us really want for its own sake, is to be happy. And to be happy means really fulfilling the purpose for which we were created.
Right. Being a good person actually has meaning when you understand.
Yeah, it's not just being nice.
Right, exactly.
Or polite.
Yeah, yeah.
Which those are nice. Those are good to have.
And those are certainly part of it, but they have to be, you know, they have to be put in context of, I'm going to live a life for a certain purpose. I'm going to live a life or make my choices for a certain purpose. You know, that way of thinking about morality is certainly not dead. You know, I see it not only coming back, but, you know, it's always kind of been in the background when you're talking about business and you're talking about, you know, you've always got that large section of the bookstore on business books. And when you start leafing through them, you quickly find the how to live the best version of yourself, you know, embedded in them. And, you know, that's closer to the traditional way of talking about morality than us simply arguing back and forth and shouting each other down when it comes to what's morally right or what's morally wrong.
And with that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then below that, in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
It never fails when I turn the radio on. It is like God is speaking directly to me.
Catholic Radio Indy.
God is definitely using that ministry.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tunnell, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. We're talking about civil and uncivil discourse. What are those things that are making our inability to have a civil discussion, have a open debate on all the things that, you know, we need to debate and need to discuss in the world? What are those things that are hindering us from actually getting somewhere with these kinds of open discussions?
Well, as we were talking about before, you know, we've got moral positions that are ultimately not just unreconcilable, but as McIntyre would say, incommensurable. We're not even talking about the same things when we're talking about it. And I think part of that goes back to how we think about morality and how we come up with our own personal ideas of what is right and what is wrong. We're long past the day where some sense of being a good person and being a holy person and being perfect and directing my life towards some sort of ideal way of living or way of being is the way everybody thinks about morality. Now, as we were saying, with this idea of radical autonomy that I can choose for myself how I should be or what I should be or who I should be, now, basically, our moral choices come down to what makes me feel good.
Right. And that's McIntyre there begins to, you begin to touch on something important. McIntyre, I think, would he develops this idea of emotivism, where emotivism is the term that points to one's feelings as sort of the primary source of, let's say, justification for one's moral or ethical views or stance. So because, and we if you listen carefully to how we're, each of us speak or others, you'll notice we use the word feel. I feel this and I feel that. I have all these feelings, which is a different way to approach the world than say, I think this, or I'm using my reason and arguments and evidence to approach things. If I relegate myself to the sphere of feelings, which are, feelings are, you really don't have really don't have a moral quality to them per se, in that we have feelings all the time. I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm angry, etc., and go down the list. And if those, and they're very changeable. They change based on moods, they change based on circumstances. Other people can say or do things that cause my feelings to change. And so feelings become a very unstable basis from which to make moral pronouncements or moral assessments. And that's what I think in part what McIntyre is warning us about with emotivism, is that it seems to be the predominant way in which we enter into these discussions of right or wrong is based on how I feel, which are again, they're very unstable, and they're unlike first principles, which have a certain kind of perennial quality to them.
Right. And, you know, I think one of the big signs of this is I won't say total agreement. I think it's still a little bit of a controversial idea, but more or less agreement that our basic moral beliefs are formed pre-rationally. In other words, we form our moral beliefs and what we believe are right and wrong long before we think about them. And the thought process, any rationality that we would put towards right and wrong, we come about sort of after the fact. So our moral beliefs come from something else other than rational thought. And then rational thought is put in place to kind of fit them in with the picture of the world that we have, fit them in with, you know, our experiences, etc. But right and wrong is something that comes to pre-rationally. Jonathan Haidt is a moral psychologist, and he did a lot of kind of fun experiments. He'd go hang out at McDonald's and ask people all sorts of questions, like, you know, you're sitting there eating dinner.
McRib.
Yeah, well.
Which is only available a few times a year.
Right.
Maybe only once a year.
Right. So he'd be
delicious.
Eating, right. So he'd be eating a McRib. He'd be sitting, and he'd sit down next to somebody else eating a McRib. And he'd ask him, so, you know, if you're at home and you're eating dinner with your family, and your dog, like, gets out the front door, and he runs out and into the street and gets hit by a car.
And
bad. Would it be wrong to go out and carve him up and save the pieces for dinner tomorrow night? And then
which is kind of morally repugnant, right?
Which is morally repugnant. And then yeah. he would ask the people, because most people would say, "Oh my gosh, that's awful. You can't eat Fido." But then he would follow that up with why. And that's where, you know, he started cataloging, you know, where people's moral beliefs came from. And what he found was people couldn't articulate the why. They just knew that things were morally repugnant.
They had a kind of intuition about it.
Right, exactly. And so he was following up what Hume's theory was, that moral sense and sensibility is some sort of intuition. It's some sort of intuited, feeling-based process where what we decide is right and wrong is based on just sort of how we feel about it, how we sense. You know, it makes us feel really icky when we see somebody trying to eat Fido. That makes us feel icky. That's why it's wrong, because it makes us feel icky. Mm. And that's ultimately what emotivism is that I'm basing what's right and wrong not off of a thought process, but off of what kind of, I know, will make me feel icky, make me feel uncomfortable. Mm. And so then morality does become based completely on emotion, which means, and I think this is where we get into a lot of the current shouting matches, when you do something or say something to make me feel uncomfortable, when you do something or say something to make me feel icky, you are doing and saying something that's immoral. And I have to do something about it.
Right. So negative emotions in a certain way then become the standard by which we determine the morality of things.
Right. Right. Exactly. So my whole sense of whether something's right or wrong is completely based on my emotions. And so now we've gotten far afield from the idea of you and I have things in common. You and I live together. We live in the same community.
We don't actually live together, but right, that sense, just got to be careful, Mark. These days I could be taken the wrong way. But
We live in the same community. Yeah. And we also have shared goals. You know, you and I want to put together some semblance of a radio show that people might actually listen to
from time to time.
And so we have shared goals. And so we can base our actions. We can base what we see as right and wrong off of these shared commitments that we have by living in the same community, by having the same aspirations, by having the same desires, and from that form what's right and wrong. You know, one of the codes that you and I have to live by is it is wrong to interrupt each other and shout at each other and yell at each other when we disagree because we're on the radio, and that would be awful and it would be horrible and nobody wants to listen to that.
Correct. Wouldn't be a lot of fun to experience either.
Besides, I'd just turn off your mic.
Right.
So that becomes kind of a quote unquote moral code that we have between us because it's either a prohibition or a set of actions that leads us towards a common goal, something that we hold in common. And I think we've lost that ability even to talk about those things that we hold in common within our community. We can all agree. I guess there's some things we can agree on, and maybe that's where we can sort of start some dialogue. We can all agree that there shouldn't be potholes in our roads. You know, that that's something we can all come together.
Hope the mayor's listening.
Exactly. And so then, but here's where the discourse around potholes comes. What's the best way to get rid of the potholes?
Right.
So then what's right and wrong becomes what's the right way to get rid of potholes and what's the wrong way to get rid of potholes, not whether the existence of potholes are morally right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge difference in that kind of discussion than there is in the discussion of whether something is, you know, just carte blanche right or carte blanche wrong.
Right. I think let me get your thoughts on this, Mark. Let me I think one of the issues that we face today and some of the conversations I've had with friends and colleagues, things like that, is it seems that speaking specifically about, say, America, and maybe, and this would pertain, I guess, more to Western civilization too, but it seems that one of the things that allowed us to come together as a country, and what's one of the things that makes America, it has made America, say, exceptional. In terms of as a nation compared to others throughout world history, has been this a common moral code based on the Judeo-Christian tradition found, say, an exemplary fashion in, say, the Ten Commandments, where for, you know, maybe the first couple of hundred years. Now, it ebbs and flows and has been waning, and that's why I want to bring this up to the current day, but there's it seems that if a society or nation like the United States has a, you know, general consensus to the vast majority, say over 90% of its citizens have a commitment to the Ten Commandments on these are ways in which we are going to that can be the basis for not just a posited law, but also we recognize it's also a basis for, say, natural law, divine law, eternal law, and that for self-governance. In other words, if I'm committed to living out the Ten Commandments as the way for God's plan for my life to bring about happiness and flourishing, then regardless of what the common law is of my state or nation, I'm going to, myself and like-minded people, we're going to, even if it's imperfectly, we're committed to doing things like not stealing, not committing murder, worshiping God correctly, those sorts of things. But what are the implications? Because we're not, I would say we don't have 90% plus anymore, if we ever did, but maybe there's probably reason to believe at some point there was that sort of commitment here among U.S. citizens. But with the huge fall off, especially of those under 30 years old, and as you get to around 20 years old and under two, there's this huge fall off of religious commitment and self-identifying adherence to religious, these Judeo-Christian in particular principles. What are the implications for things like moral discourse?
Yeah, because all of that leads into a common understanding of anthropology, a common understanding of what it means to be human, what it means to be a person, and ultimately what the purpose of human life is, where it is we're going. It all gives us a common understanding of who we are and where we're ultimately headed. And those, I think, are the two main ingredients that you need to really be able to have any kind of moral discourse. And I think we're going to have to
We're headed to a break.
Exactly.
We're headed right now.
Yeah, but we're going to have to unpack that a little bit right after this break.
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Most of us like to keep up on what's going on in the world and try to catch a little news each day. Did you know that you can catch the very latest Catholic news right on our website? We have news from Rome, from around the world, and here at home, updated every day so you always know what's going on from a Catholic perspective. Check it out. Go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and look for the Catholic news headlines. There's always something new at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a ministry reaching out to Central Indiana and beyond. We have information available about what's happening in parishes here in the Hoosier Heartland, as well as access to the latest from Rome, plus apologetics and authentic Catholic teaching. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford, and we are discussing things. So we are.
There are
different modes of discussion and different methods that we can use to structure social discourse. What are those, and how are we going to make them work in this world?
Yeah, you know, I homeschool my kids, and so we're giving them a classically based education. And part of that classically based education is the study of the liberal arts. So those skills...
You're turning them into progressives.
Well, no, not at all.
Exactly. That term liberal has been changed over time.
Right. Well, you know, the liberal arts are those skills that you need to be free. I mean, that's ultimately what the liberal arts are, that set of skills that you need. And so, you know, of those linguistically, you know, within those, you've got grammar, but then you've got rhetoric and logic. And those two are how you discourse, how you come to the truth, how you dialogue with somebody else, either through rhetoric, trying to put your position forward in a way that's persuasive and is going to bring other people along to your point of view, or through logic, being able to dissect the truth within the statements of what somebody else has said. Mm-hmm. Those are traditionally the ways we discourse, but those aren't available to us when we don't have a common understanding of who we are as people and where we're headed. And because we don't have that common understanding of who we are and where we're headed, we don't have a common goal to pursue. And when we don't have a common goal to pursue, we can't talk about what's the best way to get there or what's not the best way to get there.
Because we're not headed there.
And so we're left with that. We're ultimately left without tools to to discourse. There's no point in eloquent rhetoric when I have no chance whatsoever of persuading you of something because you're not even thinking on the same planet as I am when it comes to how we should live or how we shouldn't live. And so we're really left without any sort of tools of rhetoric or logic to be able to bring each other along.
Yeah, that is one of the most that might be the number one problem that we face in conversations today, conversations of things that are truly meaningful and significant. Is you're right, if we don't have a common goal or a common destination in mind, then there's you know, if you're headed to Toledo and I'm headed to Cheyenne, well, of course we're not going to agree on which roads to take.
Right, exactly. And so what winds up happening is, since we can't rationally talk about which roads to take, we wind up shouting about which roads to take.
Right.
So, the one of us that's going to prevail in this discourse of which road we take isn't so much who has the better plan to get to Cheyenne or to get to
Toledo.
Toledo. Okay. Yeah. It was the other option.
Why I picked those two cities, but they're not in the same direction.
They're not in the same direction. And we're talking about desirable places to go and head. I'm not sure either of them are, but anyway,
nothing against Toledo or Cheyenne.
Correct. Especially if we have listeners there.
Right. But anyway, if we're having this debate over which road to take and you want to get to Cheyenne and I want to get to Toledo, which one of us is going to win? The one that's driving the car.
Right.
Ultimately there's no sense in trying to rationally dialogue about this or have a rational discussion about it, because your goal is Cheyenne, mine's Toledo, and they're as McIntyre would say, incommensurable. So because of that, one of us has to be able to drive the car, and we both know whoever's driving the car, we're the ones that's going to win this debate. And so that's not rational discourse anymore. That's a power struggle.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think that's what our moral discourse within our society has devolved into, is various forms of power struggles to decide who's going to get to drive the car, to figure out whether we're going to wind up in Cheyenne or whether we're going to wind up in Toledo.
So that sounds a lot like Nietzsche. It sounds like Nietzsche's Will to Power, where in part he had argued or laid out that there isn't really no objective truth. It's really more everyone has their own perspective. And because these perspectives can be a great variance, then what's really going on is we're engaged in this contest of wills by which the powerful seeking power and domination one over the other. And this is why grabbing in these really heated debates, you begin to see what appeals to things like, or what being brought to bear are things like power. So as an example, recently that was in the news, Ireland obviously had been, it's a Catholic nation, at least according to their constitution. Seems like that's really been falling by the wayside recently. But they recently passed a legalized abortion in Ireland, and it came to light recently, as I think I saw it even yesterday, that one of the large social media outlets had been purposefully suppressing pro-life posts and information and things in an effort to intentionally sway the political debate, and not just debate, but there was a referendum, so there actually was a political outcome that they influenced. And that to me sounds very totalitarianism.
Yeah, it's very totalitarian, and it comes from this problem of not being able to find any sort of mechanism to actually have a rational discussion about what's best for the country. Then it becomes a power struggle of who's going to decide what's best for the country.
And once we decide, then whatever means we need to do to bring it about becomes licit.
Exactly.
In their minds.
Exactly. And the quickest way to win this debate is to silence the other side in one way or the other. Yeah. So that attempt to, use, whether you're using you know, the power that you have as the one that's in control of the platform for speech, you know, social media or whatever, or whether, and you know, it can go beyond just social media. I mean, if you've got control over the physical space that you allow for public discourse, let's say you've got control of the college campus. And so you you can decide who is allowed to speak there and who isn't allowed to speak there.
Right.
Then you can make sure that none of the speakers that are invited to your campus are those that would disagree with your opinion. Right. And then, and we see that,
that applies. Yeah, that applies to the administration on one hand, who and groups on campus that make those decisions. But then increasingly, we also have what students, you know, significant, you know, loud and at times I would say threatening. Factions of the student body on these campuses have successfully driven away speakers whom they disagree with.
Right. And, you know, I find that instinct to be fascinating and also, I think, a verification of what we're saying, that we've completely lost the ability for rational discourse. That when you hear something that you disagree with, your first instinct now, and I think, you know, I think this goes to just about everybody, the first instinct is to protest. You know, it's not to come up with objections. It's not to figure out how to argue against it. It's to protest. And so protest, and if not protest, it's to express your indignation, your moral injury and insult that you've taken at this. So it's one or the other, to show that you've been injured and insulted by this idea, or to protest. Those are our moral instincts now. That's what we do first, and then, you know, maybe we might get to the point of thinking through, you know, how we would argue against this idea.
Yeah, that is a huge problem and a huge impasse to this notion that we've been talking about today on the show about trying to engage in civil discourse. So, Mark, what might be some ways to overcome these challenges that we've been talking about?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is train ourselves back into a more classical understanding of ethics and morality. And that starts with getting rid of the idea that morality is some sort of theoretical science, that you can rationally come to some conception of goodness in itself by studying what's morally right and studying what's morally wrong and coming up with some sort of ethical calculus to figure out the right thing to do at the right time. You know, that leads to utilitarianism, and utilitarianism leads ultimately, it breaks down and falls apart and leads to emotivism, as we were talking about. If it doesn't lead to utilitarianism, it leads to some sort of the big word here, deontological understanding of what's right.
You brought in Immanuel Kant.
I did, and usually I'm here to defend Kant because I find a lot of
Kant, Heidegger, Hegel. It's been a while, Marx, exactly, since you dragged in your unholy trio.
Right. Yeah, but I you know, in this point, I'm going to have to cast aspersions on my man Kant a little bit here, because you know, deontology is ultimately the idea that we can come up with a set of absolute rational laws that we all intuitively know, that we can then weigh each and every case against to decide, you know, whether this is right or wrong. For Kant, it was the universal imperative. You know, if this is something that can't be like a universal law of nature, then it can't be like a universal law of morality. Mm-hmm. So without a universal law of morality, you know, then we really can't have moral discourse. And so he was trying to find what that universal moral law was. And it was pretty much that which can't be universalized shouldn't be allowed, which, you know, you can quibble about that. You can restate that in some, you know, I think what he was trying to do was philosophically restate the golden rule: do unto others as I would have done unto myself. You know, I think he was trying to restate that as a moral maxim that we can all weigh things off of and come to some common ground. He's trying to give that some philosophical rigor. But ultimately I think he failed. And so I think getting rid of that idea that we can come up with some, you know, basic universalizable law that if we all can just, you know, base everything we do off of this law, then everything, you know, we'll be able to talk about it in discourse. And that ultimately falls apart too. You know, I think we've got to get back to the idea that morality and ethics is eminently practical. It's about problem solving. It's about figuring out how to live a good life. It's about figuring out what the purpose of human life is and talking at that level before we start getting into the, okay, then are these sets of actions things that are going to contribute to that, or are these sets of actions things that are going to deteriorate from that? And that means talking about what kind of community we want to live in. You know, I think when we pull the practical study of practical science of morality down to a practical level, we're talking about ultimately, what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of society do we want to live in? What kind of community do we want to live in? And from there, then we can talk about, to do that, what kind of actions should we be allowing and not allowing within our city? And I think when we start talking along those lines, we can find some common ground and some wiggle room and discussion, even when we disagree.
And we need to take a break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell, still in the cave, Mark Tuttle and Kent Blanford. And we've been talking about our inability, and now it's shifting slightly to our ability, to find avenues by which we can have moral discourse. Mark, I want to pick up on your comments right before the break and ask you, I'm going to bring up the V word, virtue. And tell us a little bit about where virtue fits in with the moral system you've been describing, or moral vision you've been describing.
Yeah, I think anybody that looks at ethics and morality and the history of ethics and morality sees that prior to the Enlightenment, all moral discourse was around the idea of virtue. You know, what makes a virtue? What are the seven virtues? How do we exhibit those? You read Thomas Aquinas's section in the Summa on ethics and morality, and it's exactly that. It's a discussion of the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues, the seven mm-hmm. virtues that we have to have. And then on the other side of that, he talks about the vices that are to be avoided, and that's moral discourse. And then with the Enlightenment, that shifts, and that shifts towards, you know, utilitarianism, the mm-hmm. deontology that we just talked about, mm-hmm. trying to find some sort of universal principle that we can all mm-hmm. apply at any given time to figure out what's right and wrong. So rather than forming our character, which was the purpose of ethics and morality prior to the Enlightenment, making good decisions becomes the emphasis for the, after the Enlightenment, of how can we choose what to do? So we move from character, what makes a good person, to choices, what makes good choices. And then paramount to that, when you talk about freedom, you have very different conceptions of freedom when you're talking about mm-hmm. virtue versus when you're talking about some choice-based system. So if you're talking about freedom in a virtue-based system, you're talking about being able to form your character, which means you have to be sort of free of anything that would impede your ability to form your character, vices, mm-hmm. other people imposing their will on you to a certain extent that can stunt your character when you're in a situation where you can't act virtuously. Those are impediments of freedom where mm-hmm. in after the Enlightenment, the emphasis becomes freedom is the absence of something that would restrict your choices. So freedom is ultimately the ability to be able to choose. And so you wind up with very different understandings of freedom. And, you know, as we've talked about for most of this show, the post-Enlightenment view of morality, where we're trying to find that universal principle where we can decide what's right and wrong, that's ultimately led to a situation where we can't talk about morality at all. You know, the terminology is broken. The positions that we have are completely incommensurable, etc. So what's our alternative? Well, we can continue down the road that we're on, which is this power-based struggle of mm-hmm. me trying to assert myself a la Nietzsche, or we can go back to some sort of virtue-based understanding of morality. Of morality and ethics is really about forming character and virtue and avoiding vice and creating environments where virtue flourishes and vice diminishes.
Right. I think one of the examples I think of that where there it has gone a little bit astray at times, but one of the areas where I think we can one of the basic human goods, like as a John Finnis would point out, would be that brings about human flourishing would be, say, health. And we still have some common understanding as to what constitute good health around, say, exercise and nutrition. So
now you're judging me.
Right. Or I'm being judged. I can have a weakness for Big Macs and they're not that helpful, healthy. But there does seem to be some common pursuits around or common agreement that health is a good that's worth pursuing. Now we pursue it imperfectly. But then you also have instances, again, where you had, I think it was Mayor Bloomberg in New York who insisted that, had targeted soda and had decided that, for the good of society, the society of which he had some control over, they outlawed, right? They literally outlawed, larger sodas. Like you couldn't buy a certain size, like over 32 ounces or over 16 ounces or some. So why wouldn't you just buy two?
Right. Well, I think that's a great example of the difference between the two ethical systems when you think about it. You know, a virtue-based system is going to talk about health in terms of what a healthy person does and what kind of habits a healthy person has and how to cultivate those healthy habits and how to live a healthy life. The more choice-based, whether it's utilitarianism or deontology, those more choice-based systems are going to think of it in terms of what you decide. And so the goal then is to try to help people make healthy choices. And one of the ways to help people make healthy choices is by prohibiting bad choices.
Right.
So that urge to prescribe or to prescribe good behavior or bad behavior by using power, which ultimately that's what force of law is, fits within that post-enlightenment, we can't argue about these things anymore, system that we all kind of live in, where, a virtue-based system, it's about cultivating habits, it's about educating people, it's about trying to create an environment where people can have healthy habits, and creating an environment where the vices diminish ultimately. So there's probably some prescription involved in trying to get rid of vices, but it's two very different ways of looking about bringing about moral actions, even when we can agree on what those moral actions are. I think everybody in this debate agrees, sodas with lots of corn syrup and all that, they're not really healthy for you and you should avoid them. I mean, I don't think there's any real debate about that, but then the question becomes, do we bring this about by trying to cultivate virtue and a virtuous public, or do we bring this about by using the force of law and power to keep people from making bad choices?
Right. And what seems, kind of on the face of it, just ridiculous is the assertion of the force of law, of power, and of coercion, because there's penalties, right? If you pass a law, there's penalties, or pass an ordinance, there's penalties that go along with it. And I can't remember if jail was part of it or not, or just probably was fines if you were caught as a vendor selling, too large a soda cup. But at the same time though, in New York City, they also have in one of their zip codes there, they also have the plight of having more abortions than live births in one, at least one of their zip codes. So here you have, so think about how fragmented the moral vision is there, where on one hand you have, thousands of innocent babies being killed through abortion, and the force of law not being applied to protect and save them, but rather to restrict how much Coca-Cola you can drink in any one purchase.
Right. And that comes about, that becomes about because of the incommensurability that we've been talking
Correct.
About.
Correct.
You've got two very different competing, I hate this term, but I'm going to use it, worldviews, where one recognizes, you know, the destruction of a human person as being morally wrong, and the other recognizes the, you know, I guess, restriction of somebody's sexual choices to be morally wrong. And those just, they're not compatible. You know, there's no amount of debate that's going to happen aside from completely converting one person from one worldview to the other worldview that's going to change, because we're not even talking about the same things. We're not talking about the same goods. So the idea of moral debate, and you see it in the abortion debate, quote unquote. What does the abortion debate consist of? Well, passing laws, i.e. who, you know, this power struggle to see who's going to get control of the government. And you see the discourse being protest, you know, mass protests. We pro-lifers are a lot better at it than the pro-choicers, which is good. And then finally, indignation, the horror and just, you know, sob stories and you know, trying to pull on people's heartstrings with story after story. And unfortunately, the pro-choice people are better at that than we pro-lifers are. You know, they're better at bringing forward these poor women whose lives have just been decimated because they can't have an abortion and destroy their unborn child. They're able to bring those stories forward to pull on legislators, and all of it's just a big power game, rather than us talking about a sense of virtue. You know, what is the virtuous thing to do that is going to allow us to live a more human life, to have a community that flourishes and is a healthy community? Does abortion have a place within a healthy community? We don't even have that debate, because we're talking on two so radically different planes of what's morally right and morally wrong.
Yeah, and it gets down to, I think another aspect of it too, gets down to the unwantedness of the unborn child, right? That there are factors in that mother's life, but also the father's life, right? There's always a father out there. Babies just don't spontaneously, you know, conceive, right?
Right.
It's not like, you know, there are things that are happening, and there's always a man that's implicated in bringing about this life, but this unwantedness, I think, maps back to this preference this strong preference that we have as a society for autonomy and choice.
Right, exactly. That understanding of freedom as that which is going to allow me to have maximum amount of choice and you know, maximum amount of options at all times.
Right.
You know, that stands in the face of that freedom that's there to become a good person. You know, what is it that's going to allow me to become a virtuous person? And when you're looking at an unwanted, you know, I hate the term unwanted pregnancy, because all these children are wanted by somebody. You know, but an unplanned pregnancy.
Right.
When you're looking at the face of an unplanned pregnancy, and if your view of freedom is that which is going to make me most virtuous, you instantly start thinking of your responsibilities towards that child.
Now you touched on it. Responsibility.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You ultimately start thinking about your responsibility towards, you know, the mother of that child or the father of that child. Whereas if your understanding of freedom is that which leaves my choices open and my future open, that child becomes a hindrance to that. That child then stands in the way of what you want, you know, where you want to go, what your future should be or can be. And so that child is an impediment. And unfortunately, that child is completely helpless, utterly, completely, totally helpless at that point, and so very easy to destroy and get rid of.
Yeah, and especially since abortion happens pretty much in secret, right? I mean, they happen inside these abortion mills behind closed doors. Great opportunity to bring up, though, that movie Unplanned, the story of Abby Johnson's life. I mean, if you really want to, and I encourage everyone should, really become in contact with what is going on behind the doors of Planned Parenthood and other like organizations, see that movie. And it's about to come out on DVD.
Yeah.
Because I've already pre-ordered it.
Right. Yep.
On Amazon.
Middle of August, I believe.
Yes.
It's going to be released.
Well, that is about all the time we have for The Catholic Cave for today. In the future, we'll do a little better job of discussing things and not trying to talk over each other and that kind of thing. Although, gentlemen, I must compliment you. I won't have to edit a single thing today. So you both,
thanks, Mark, for not using F-bombs.
You both get gold stars. And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. For Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.